Well, for those of you who are joining this morning and weren't here yesterday and weren't here Friday night, I don't think I'm going to try to summarize everything that we've been talking about since we began, but I think you already know that we're studying the Mahaparinirvana Sutta from the Digha Nikaya and the Pali Canon. And maybe you already know the sutra, probably you do, and studied it before. Also, in the past, I've studied it in my Dharma seminar, and all of those talks are online. You can stream them, and there's no charge. So everydayzen.org is the website. So if you missed those talks, you could actually hear them in a slightly different form on the website. The website has so many Dharma talks on it that it has a Google function. So you could type in Mahaparinirvana Sutta, and you'll get a whole range of talks on it. So that's why I'm not going to summarize anything. So you could, if you're interested, you could look it up. But anyway, it doesn't really matter, right? Who's missing what? Anything? We're missing anything? No. So we can always start from right now, and that's all we need. Having said that, though, I am going to back up slightly from where we left off yesterday. Remember, we left off when the Buddha had eaten what turned out to be his last meal, where he had, we think, truffles. Do you ever have truffles? You don't have them very often. They're very precious and hard to find. But after you read this Mahaparinirvana Sutra, probably you would never want to eat them again, because the Buddha ate them and he got really sick, painfully sick. And it turns out, as you'll see, that was his last meal. That meal probably killed him. Anyway, I'm backing up. Before he ate that meal, he gave another Dharma talk. In this sutta, the Buddha's traveling around all the time and he's giving Dharma talks, and we're paying attention to those Dharma talks because we're thinking, well, now that he's coming to the end of his life, he's saying the things that are most important. So he said them all before, but he's sort of emphasizing, well, these are the things I want you to remember now that I'm coming to the end of my life. So I'm going to quote again what I quoted last time. Because when I quoted it the first time, I just sort of quoted it and left it at that. And this time, because he's listing the most important teachings, you know all this already, I know you do, but I feel that it's our duty, since he's listing all these teachings, to mention them and underscore them and talk about them a little bit, even though you know them. We should do this. Because as you know, a Dharma talk is not information. It's a ritual. And the ritual requires that we do honor to these teachings. So I'm going to repeat them, and then, unlike before, when I merely repeated them, this time I'm going to say something about them. So here's the quotation. Thereupon the Blessed One entered the hall of audience, and taking the seat prepared for him, he exhorted the bhikkhus, saying, "Now, O bhikkhus, I say to you that these teachings of which I have direct knowledge and which I have made known to you, these you should thoroughly learn, cultivate, develop, and frequently practice, that the life of purity may be established and may long endure. For the welfare and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, well-being, and happiness of gods and human beings." Because what are these teachings? They are the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four constituents of psychic power, the five faculties, the five powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, and the Noble Eightfold Path. These, bhikkhus, are the teachings of which I have direct knowledge, which I have made known to you, and which you should thoroughly learn, cultivate, develop, and frequently practice, that the life of purity may be established and may long endure for the welfare and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, well-being, and happiness of gods and human beings. Then the Blessed One said to the bhikkhus, "So, bhikkhus, I exhort you, all compounded things are subject to vanish. Strive with earnestness. The time of the Tathagata's parinibbana is near. 3 months hence, the Tathagata will utterly pass away." So, I already read you that, but I wanted to now just mention these 37 practices that the Buddha mentions. And the list begins with the four foundations of mindfulness, teachings that we all know well, the most foundational, fundamental teachings of Buddha Dharma. Mindfulness is sati in Pali and smriti in Sanskrit. It actually means to remember. I was saying the other day, actually, I think spiritual practice is so simple and easy. There's not that much to it, really. The hard thing is remembering to do it, because, you know, circumstances are constantly pulling us away. So mindfulness just means, basically, remember to do your practice. That's what it really means. It means to remember, to recall. And, you know, to be present, to stay alert, to stay awake, to stay aware. And this is the first teaching that the Buddha mentions. And nowadays, everybody's talking about mindfulness, so we're all quite aware of it. But when you think about it, if somebody didn't say mindfulness, you would never even think of such a thing, because you would just assume it. You would say, well, yeah, I'm present, I'm conscious, I'm aware. Of course I am. I mean, when I'm sleeping, I'm not. But as soon as I woke up, I was aware I was up. I knew I walked across the floor. I knew I had my coffee. All day long, I knew that I was aware, you know, of everything. So what mindfulness? Aren't I always mindful anyway? Don't we all assume that? And the idea that our awareness, that our presence, that the being here-ness of our life is something that you could practice, right? That you could practice this, that you could enhance this, that you could develop it. This, I think, I know I would never have dreamed of such an idea, right? Never. I would have thought, well, I could get more information, I could learn things, maybe I could develop my intelligence somehow, but that I could develop the awareness itself, I would never have thought of that. Even though now, like I say, there's so much discussion of mindfulness, we now understand that we can develop this. But this is something that was a subtle understanding of the Buddha, and I really admire the Buddha for having, it's kind of like the greatest discoveries are the most simple-minded things, right? Who would have thought? Just like meditation, who would think that it would be a good idea to sit down and do nothing but breathe? It's like, what? You know, that's ridiculous. You know, get up and do something. Why would you just sit there and do nothing? Who would have ever thought that this could be one of the most valuable things a human being could do? We would have never thought of that on our own. So I really appreciate the Buddha for thinking of these totally stupid things that nobody would have, you know, that there it was, and yet nobody would have thought of it. So mindfulness practice is nothing more than remembering to stay with the object of awareness, which means, as we all know, when you forget it, which it turns out you do all the time, you remember to remember it again. you return over and over again when you forget. So we are, in fact, always mindful. I mean, when they give like psychological factors of mind in Buddhist Abhidhamma, it says, anytime you are conscious, there is a degree of mindfulness present. Otherwise, you're not conscious. But being mindful and practicing mindfulness, developing mindfulness, are two different things. Remembering to return to the object of awareness, even if the object is presence itself, that cultivation of that practice extends and deepens our awareness, even though some awareness is always there whenever we're conscious. And this deceptively simple factor, simple practice, which is almost like too simple, right? That's what makes it hard. It's too simple. This is the first thing that the Buddha mentions when he's mentioning, when he's at the end of his life, when he's telling you what's important. This is the first thing that's important. So the four foundations of mindfulness, as we all know, mindfulness of the body, which includes the breathing and the posture of the body as we practice in meditation. But the Buddha means not only, meditation is a time to develop that mindfulness. It's a very good, it's a simple situation, meditation. Every complexity is thrown away. So in this very simple situation, you can develop the mindfulness. But the idea is that you would extend it all the time, as we were saying the other day. Even to shitting and pissing, this would be like an opportunity to practice mindfulness. So this already is very counterintuitive. Like, what would be like the summa of spiritual practice, being aware of shitting and pissing, really? Of breathing? Of your body? It doesn't seem like that's very spiritual, right? Or sacred. And yet, that's what the Buddha is proposing here. It's the most important factor for awakening, is mindfulness of the body. The second is mindfulness of what's called vedana, feeling sensation. Is probably the best English translation of vedana, which means the somatic basis of what we generally call emotion. And generally, feeling sensation is unconscious. It is not available generally to our awareness, even though it's deeply motivating. Maybe this is something the behavioral economists are studying, right? They're coming into realizing that vedana is really important as a motivating factor. It's not just what we think, but it's this unconscious somatic basis of emotion that's important. But when we're aware of body and breath, and we have a practice of being aware of body and breath, it usually happens quite spontaneously, actually, without our needing to think about it, that we will become aware of vedana. We will become aware of sensation, feeling, the basic climate of our passions. The third foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of the more complex mental and emotional states, which we are aware of, which are mixtures of thinking and feeling and storytelling. So when we say emotions, we will actually mean thinking, feeling, bodily sensations, and the stories we tell ourselves about that thinking and feeling and bodily sensations. And that's the third foundation of mindfulness, to be aware of all of this in the context of our awareness of feeling sensation and our awareness of the body. And when we practice all of that, then we understand our emotions and thoughts quite differently. You know, we take our emotions, our thoughts completely at face value, but now we have a bigger, deeper picture of them. And we practice being aware of all of this as we go on. And eventually, we will have access to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, based on our deep cultivation of the other three, over a lifetime of practice, we will be able to be mindful of the deep human patterns of delusion and awakening. We will understand the shape of our own suffering and the suffering of others. And understanding that, we will also understand the shape of awakening. And because it'll be clear to us that this is not just our, our emotions are ours personally. You know, I feel this way because this happened to me. It's different for you. But when we get to this fourth foundation, it's clear that this bigger picture of my own life is identical, not in its particulars, but in its shape, to the picture of your life too. So this makes me empathetic, understanding, and caring of others. So that's my little mini Dharma talk on the four foundations of mindfulness, which you already know. Next comes the four right efforts, Samapadana. And these are based, effort sounds like a neutral thing, but actually effort here specifically relates to discrimination between wholesome and unwholesome states of mind, that we would be able to tell the difference. And that we would, the effort here has to do with a clear desire to continue with wholesome states of mind and to gradually let go of unwholesome states of mind. This is foundational in Buddhist practice, but most of us are not at all clear about this difference, right? Because we're not organizing our lives based on unwholesome and wholesome. We're organizing our lives based on, what do I want? What's good for me? So a lot of the times, I think, if we're honest with ourselves, we would say, yes, it's really true that I do favor my own willful desires and needs over my commitment to cultivate wholesome and let go of unwholesome thoughts. So these four right efforts require that we shift that, and we say, well, yeah, I have my needs and my desires and all that, but I get it now that that's not the path that's going to serve me. I'm better off committing myself to cultivating and letting go of wholesome and unwholesome thoughts, respectively. And so the four right efforts have to do with that. So, in other words, they're not just about heroic exertion. They're about this particular kind of commitment and practice. So, here's how they are traditionally, the four right efforts are traditionally stated like this. First, the effort to practice, this is kind of odd, right? The effort to practice the non-arising of unwholesome states that have not yet arisen. It's kind of an odd idea, right? Practice something that isn't there, right? How would you do that? Like to make it specific, you'd say, well, I'm not angry right now. So right now I'm going to like intentionally practice the non-anger that I now have. It's hard to know. Like, how would you do that exactly? Maybe you'd do it by saying, well, now that I'm not angry, I'm going to practice love. I'm going to cultivate love and think about loving kindness and as a way of practicing the non-arising of anger. I don't know. It's a little hard to understand how you do that. The second is the effort to abandon wholesome states that have arisen. And that we can understand, right? So now, we were talking upstairs about anger. Now anger is here. I see that anger is here. So my right effort is to abandon anger the best I can. And often, we don't do that. Anger is like so powerful in us that we don't think of abandoning it. In fact, we usually have a ton of thoughts that justify it. of course I'm angry. No, I should be angry, and so on and so on. But this would be, no, no, I'm angry, so I'm making the effort to let go of the anger. The third is the effort to cultivate wholesome states that have not yet arisen. So this one, to me, seems pretty much like the first. I'm not feeling very loving right now, but I'm going to, like, intentionally practice loving kindness so that the loving feeling that I'm not feeling will appear in me. So that sort of makes sense, right? Maybe the only difference between this one and the first one would be here, we're doing it for its own sake, and in the first case, we're doing it to make sure that hatred doesn't arise. In Zen practice, we don't really pay that much attention to all these different lists. The effort is to just be present all the time. So in Zen practice, there's not that much specific discussion of wholesome and unwholesome states. The effort is to notice the state you're in, hold it with a light touch and with patience. And in Zen, we also practice precepts, ethical conduct, which is an effort to let go of selfishness and expand the sphere of our sense of identity to include others. So we study our own narrow, painful experiences of self-defensiveness, and we try to let go. And the fourth one is to maintain wholesome states that have arisen, to encourage them and further them. Next come the four constituents of psychic power, or Walsh's translation is the four roads to power, he calls them. And I think these are usually the sort of superpowers, you know, of ancient India. The amazing capacity to be at two places at once, to be able to, you know, like walk through walls like Superman. Clairvoyance, clairaudience, the ability that the Buddha had to discern past and future lives and so on. And such powers were said to exist as fruits of deep trance practice, before the Buddha ever appeared on the scene. There was a very highly developed Indian tradition of meditation, and all these things were included. And a lot of what's included in Buddhist meditation was already, I mean, the Buddha studied all this. He had teachers right before his awakening. So all this stuff is not really Buddhist particularly, and the Buddha shifted all of it with his understanding. So even though he listed them here, usually we don't think of them as, that's not what we're trying to do. Like, there was a time, there were some meditators. Remember this moment? Maybe some of you are too young to remember when there was a whole thing about meditators who were like learning how to levitate. Remember that? And they would report, well, I got up about 3-4 inches. I was sailing around, you know. Somebody said, wow, I flew across the room. So there was a moment, you know, when there was that. But pretty much, I don't think that's what most of us are trying to accomplish. And in Zen especially, there's a lot of fun, there's a lot of satirical attitude about this sort of thing, you know. Makes fun of these powers. And they're the famous, in Zen, Laiman Pong, famously says, ah, I have great esoteric powers. I can produce miracles. You know what my miracles are? My miracles are I chop wood and I carry water. And so there's this idea in Zen that everyday life, like making breakfast, this is like a superpower, you know, unbelievable. When you think about it, it is pretty amazing, you know, that you could make breakfast, clean up after breakfast, you could get in a car, you could come over here, you could listen to me talking and have some understanding of the words that I'm saying, which are, after all, just little vibrations that are going across the room and wanging in your eardrum, and all of a sudden, you know, you think I'm talking and you're listening to something, you know. This is a miracle, isn't it? We would need more miracles than this? No, not really. So the next two lists are the five faculties and the five powers, which are the same list. But they're listed twice because when an ordinary person practices them, they're called faculties. And when a sage practices them, the same qualities are called powers, because the sage has, you know, mastered them and brought them to another level, and it's different, but the list is the same. Faith or confidence, energy, or maybe joyful effort, zestful effort, mindfulness, which was already mentioned, concentration, and wisdom. And when this list is spoken of, it's always said faith and energy by themselves can get out of whack, and they must be balanced by wisdom and meditation, which also can get out of whack if they're not balanced by faith and energy. So that's kind of interesting, right? Meditation could be overdone. It has to be balanced by faith and energy. And you've seen people who are like fanatically into faith, right? Who are constantly trying to talk you into what they believe and so on. So that's out of balance. Or if you ever had a teenage son, you know that energy can get out of balance and drive you crazy. So yeah, faith needs wisdom, energy needs settled meditation to temper them. But, interestingly, in this list of five, mindfulness doesn't need a balancing factor, because by its nature, it cannot get out of control. You can't be overly mindful. You can be overly attached to your own mental states and go crazy. You know, like, sometimes I think people make themselves crazy with what they think is mindfulness, looking at every little piece of thought that might flash across their mind, you know. But I don't think that's actually mindfulness. That's like self-obsession. That's not the same. People think mindfulness and self-obsession are the same thing. I don't think so. I think mindfulness and self-obsession are the same. It's that mindfulness is the opposite. Mindfulness, in a way, is like not caring about yourself, right? It's just being aware of what's happening. I don't care. There's this, there's that, I don't care. I'm just looking. I'm just aware of it. So this can't be overdone, real mindfulness. Okay, so the seven factors of enlightenment are mindfulness, there it is again, the third time appearing in these lists. Mindfulness, investigation of dharmas, which means basically the desire to ascertain what's wholesome and unwholesome, what's real and not real. Energy, there it is again. Joy or rapture. And this is a very important thing, because there is a tendency to view spiritual practice as a dutiful slog. So if you're dutifully slogging along year after year and you forgot about that this is supposed to give you joy, then think again. Next one is relaxation or tranquility of body and mind. Because again, spiritual practice can make a person extremely uptight, right, intense. Because now I'm so worried about my wholesome and unwholesome states of mind that I'm like completely wound up in knots. I can't even like see straight. I'm so tense, you know. So no, you should be relaxed. practice should be relaxing. And there should be literally some tranquility. Meditation practice will produce some tranquility of body once in a while, you know. So I hope you all experience that. I always figured that who would come and continue to practice meditation if they didn't like it, right? Who would just do it like going to the dentist or something? You know it's good for you, so you do it. No, I think we all, if we continue with this practice, we find some pleasure in it. And there could be so much pleasure that you could like become a fanatic. All I want to do is be on retreat. It's so pleasant. It's so nice. My friends are such a bother to me, you know. In meditation retreat, nobody talks to me, nobody bothers me, my body feels good, the food is nice, this forest place is so beautiful, the sky is nice. I don't want to do anything else. Wouldn't be good, let's see. Buddhist practice would say, no, you got to balance that with other things. But yes, there is a certain amount of tranquility and equanimity involved. And that's a factor. You need that for awakening. Concentration and equanimity is the last one. And then the last list of the seven factors of enlightenment, and the last list that the Buddha mentions here in this important Dharma talk, right before he's not going to give another Dharma talk. This is, I think, maybe his last Dharma talk. I can't remember. I think the last one. He mentions, again, the Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So this includes, basically, first, our attitude and our understanding. So it's kind of like your attitude is the climate of your whole life. You know, like if you have a bad attitude, the whole world is dim. And, you know, it's easy to, you look at the world and everything is wrong. Everything is bad. Nothing is working right. And you have evidence everywhere for that. And you don't realize that evidence only appears to me as such because I feel this way already. This is how I understand the world. I understand the world to be a place where nothing works, everything's against me, and things don't go right. That's how I understand the world. And I'm sure it's that way. So right understanding and right attitude, right intention is something other than that. And the Eightfold Path also includes our outward conduct, not only our these others, many, there's a lot of focus here on our inner awareness, right? Our awareness and our attitudes and our thoughts and our emotions. But here in the Eightfold Path, we learn that part of practice is right livelihood, right action, right speech. These are all very important parts of practice. And finally, the last members of the Eightfold Path refer to our inner somatic and psychic cultivation, the right effort part, the right concentration, and the right mindfulness. Anyway, everybody knows all this. You've been hearing about it for the last 25 years, so I'm sure you've heard all this before. However, since it is the Buddha's last Dharma talk, we must dutifully explain these things as part of our ritual of this Dharma talk and our proper sharing of these words in the sutra. Sometimes they call Buddhism a religion of lists. So here in the last Dharma talk, the Buddha gives a list of 37 things, you know, that should be practiced. And you can imagine why these lists are so good, because especially if you're an illiterate monastic who doesn't have any books and has a hard time remembering the last Dharma talk, you can remember the list. And the list is basically, and it's also very good if you're a Dharma teacher. All you have to do is like pull out the list and then you know what to say. What are you going to talk about today? Oh, let's see. How about the seven factors of enlightenment? I know them very well, and I'll just... So it's really a good idea. You know, it's very, very good pedagogical technique to have all these lists, right? To me, I don't know, maybe you don't agree with me, but to me it's a little deceptive, though. Because it makes it sound like spiritual practice is a rational step-by-step course of study that begins over here, you go to here and here and here and here and here, and you get to the end, you know? It makes it sound more organized than, in my opinion, it actually is. It's not quite as rational and sensible as it appears. To me, practice is more creative, more imaginative, more impressionistic, taking many twists and turns in dialogue with what's happening in the outside, the things that happen in our lives and in the world around us, rather than just my inner cultivation, regardless of what's happening. And did you ever think, you know, why is there so much overlap and repetition in these lists? If they're so, you know, rational and careful, how come, what, they made a mistake and forgot, oh, I just mentioned mindfulness in the last list, now I'm mentioning it again here? Well, why? To me, it just comes down to a few basic things. Be aware, pay attention to your life, have a little gratitude. You don't have to be alive, you know. And you won't be pretty soon. And be grateful for this. And pay attention to it. And receive it as a precious gift. Stop complaining so much, you know. You think you have a problem? You could be dead. Be grateful for your problems. And if you do pay attention, the reason why it's a good idea to pay attention is if you do pay attention, you'll start to see all this stuff unfold. It's not like you're supposed to, like, make this happen. You'll see that it is happening when you pay attention. You'll see. Wow, you know, I'm doing a lot of stuff in my own mind. And I'm saying a lot of stuff that is making me miserable, and also the people around me are also becoming pretty miserable because of the way I'm talking to them and the way I look at them and think about them. This is not good. You didn't notice that before, but when you start looking, you notice, wow, I'm doing this. I'm making suffering. I mean, maybe it's subtle, but I see it. And it's not necessary. I don't need to do this. And once you, I mean, that's the thing, it goes by suffering. You know, the path really goes by suffering. You see the suffering that was not necessarily noticeable to you. And you see that you're doing it, and you see that you don't have to do it. Why would I want to make suffering if I don't really have to make suffering? Maybe I should stop. And then you do. A flame, you know, a candle flame. It's a beautiful thing. Why don't you put your hand in it? I think I'll put my hand in that beautiful, so I can touch it. I want to touch the beautiful. But then you do that once, and then you think, oh, no, that's not. I'll look at it, but I won't touch it, right? You don't have to, like, memorize a list of 37 items to know that that's not what I want to do, right? It's kind of like that. Once you see how painful it is, you don't want to do it anymore. And you stop. You behave differently. You think differently. You feel differently. Your experience of life is different. Practice is body, speech, and mind. Body, speech, and mind. Practice is interactive. It has to do with what goes on inside and what goes on outside. It has to do with your spirit, your faith, your joy, your composure. Above all, it has to do with your capacity to remain open and flexible and not get caught by things, including yourself and your own ideas about practice. Because when you get caught, you get more suffering. You get conflict. So now we go on with our story. It's my little end of my commentary to the Buddha's 37 limbs of enlightenment. So as you will recall, we left the Buddha feeling really bad, resting by the side of the road and asking Anandi to bring him water. And again, and yet another comic turn between Ananda and the Buddha. Ananda and the Buddha begin at this point to look a little bit like Laurel and Hardy, you know what I mean? Remember Laurel and Hardy? What a fine mess you've gotten me into this time, Buddha. And so Buddha keeps telling Ananda, go get, I'm in bad shape. Go get some water. There's a stream right over there. And Ananda keeps saying, no, Buddha, no. The water is very muddy and dirty. You'd think that by now Ananda would get it, that the Buddha has powers, right? But no, Ananda still insists, I'm not going to bring you that dirty water, Buddha. It's no good for you. And Buddha finally says, get the water. And Ananda gets the water. And kaboom, it turns into being pure and perfectly clear water. So that's what we just read yesterday. Now, at this point, when the Buddha's sipping his water, down the road comes Pukkasa, a wandering mendicant. In those days, there were all kinds of religious practitioners. The roads were full of people who had abandoned everything and were just wandering around, living on alms and doing spiritual practice. It must have been really interesting, right? So here comes Pukkasa down the road. Sees the Buddha, sits down next to him, and remember, the Buddha's like in horrible pain and just feeling crappy. But he has a conversation anyway with Pukkasa. And they have a conversation, naturally, shop talk, right? They start talking about meditation. And Pukkasa is trying to impress the Buddha. He says, my meditation is so deep, he says, that one time I was a really good meditation, and I was meditating there, and 500 chariots rumbled by. But my meditation was so deep, I didn't even notice. People afterward told me, didn't you notice the 500 chariots? And I said, what 500 chariots? No, I didn't notice it. That's how deep my meditation is. And the Buddha said, well, that's pretty good. That's pretty impressive. One time, I also had some deep meditation too. And when I was meditating, there was thunder and lightning, a gigantic earthquake, but I didn't even notice. I was so enraptured by my meditation. Afterward, people said, Buddha, weren't you worried about that thunder and lightning and the earthquake and all that? And I said, what thunder? What lightning? What are you talking about? When Pukkasa heard this, he said, wow, that's better than my meditation. Will you be my teacher? I think we all understand that this is not the kind of meditation that we're practicing, right? Vipassana is not encouraging you to disappear. Although there are, in the full discussion of meditation, many of the meditations which were pre-existing Buddhism, there were those kinds of trance-like meditation. There were things where you could be buried alive, for couple of weeks, and then they'd dig you up and you'd be still alive because you weren't breathing all that time, but you were still alive, and then they would pop you up and you'd be... So this is pretty... If you are a wandering mendicant living on alms, you would like to be able to perform some tricks like that, right? Because then people give you more alms. So people did that. But this is not the meditation we're aiming for. We're Vipassana right, the name of your movement, our movement here, Vipassana, actually is telling us that, no, the kind of meditation we're aiming at is a meditation that gives us insight into the nature of our human lives so that we can live them with more happiness and more benefit to ourselves and others. So we're really not interested in going on some kind of a lights out journey. Anyway, all that happens, and Pukasa just so happens to have with him, traveling along, a set of golden robes, which he then presents to Buddha and Ananda, and they put the robes on. And in gratitude for the robes, the Buddha gives Pukasa a Dharma talk that, as the text says, it doesn't tell us what he said, but it says the Dharma talk was instructive, inspiring, fiery, and delightful. And Pukasa really appreciates it, and off he goes on his way. And Morris Walsh, there's a number of translations of this text, but in Morris Walsh's translation, he has a footnote at this point. And if you look up the footnote, it says, "This ridiculous story is a later addition." So I don't think, if I recall correctly, I don't think he gives you like evidence why. He knows it's a later edition, but he just says that. But it's a good reminder, because it reminds us all that when you're reading any ancient religious text, we should all remember there is no such thing as an original, correct edition. Every edition is corrupt. Every edition, for sure, has. Like, for example, nobody can, who really reads the text, could deny that there is a very misogynistic strain in the Buddhist canon. There certainly is. But that's a ridiculous later edition. I really think so. I really think that there was a bunch of misogynistic monastics who, when the texts came to them and they copied them over again, they added what they thought were really good ideas about misogynistic stuff, and it was a later edition. I really think that. But it's hard to prove. You have to go on expeditions to caves to dig up texts and find, and then carbon date them to figure out which is earlier, and so on and so on and so on. And you never get to the end of that. You never know. So I think you assume that every text is corrupt, and that you never know whether something... I mean, there are ways of being more sure or less sure, but anyway, the truth always comes crooked or slanted, I think Emily Dickinson says, right? That's the truth doesn't come straightforwardly. It always comes slanted. We always have to discern the truth. And in the case of religion, there's a point in history where someone says, a group of people usually get together and they say, from this day forward, this is the official true text. And the reason they do that is because there's so many different versions that it's getting confusing. So they just sort of like somewhat arbitrarily say, this from now on is it. And then you have to, because spiritual practice and religion is a communal affair in which, if we're going to have a community, we have some kind of authority that we at least provisionally recognize, temporarily at least. We honor that, right? We don't say, sometimes we say, well, okay, that's the canon, but there's another text over here. But more or less we honor those decisions. Anyway. An aside, back to the story. Off they go to Kakuta. The Buddha bathes and drinks a little more water, and he lies down in the lion posture. which means he lies down on his right side with one foot on top of the other, mindful and clearly aware. And it says, bearing in mind the time of awakening. So as he's lying there, he says to Ananda, I've been thinking. It seems possible to me that when Kunda finds out what's happening, he will feel bad having given me that food. So I want you to be sure to tell Kunda that far from feeling remorseful, he should feel happy. Because there are two absolutely essential offerings in the Buddha's life that are more prized than any other offering. The first one is the offering of food that precedes his awakening, that gives him the strength to live. And the final offering of food before his parinirvana, that gives him the strength to die. These two offerings are prized above all. Please tell this to Kunda so he doesn't feel bad. So what do we learn from this about living and dying? Even after renouncing the life force and being tired out and ready to leave this life and even being in pain in a very unpleasant physical state, the Buddha doesn't stop traveling. The journey always goes on. And in those travels, despite all this, he's still willing to meet people, to talk to them, to teach them the Dharma as best he can, as he does with Pukhasa, even if it's a later edition. Anyway, it's in the canon, so now we read it. In hospice work, you know, we had a Zen hospice, and I was part of that for many, many years. And when we would train volunteers, we would tell the volunteers, the person dying in the bed is your best teacher. They will teach you more brightly and more perfectly than any other spiritual teacher could ever teach you. Because they are close to something, however much they take it in or not, they are close to something that is most important, most salient about this human life. So I think the Buddha also knows this. And that's why, even at this dire moment in his life, he's happy to share, even with a mendicant who happens to show up. You know, the Buddha, again, doesn't straighten this mendicant out about what a stupid idea of meditation you have. He says, oh yeah, right, me too. Right? Because he is willing to share with this person on their own terms. He doesn't need to do anything more. Nothing is silly. Every encounter is profound all the time, especially at the time of death, which when you think about it, is all the time, right? And presumably, you know, when Buddha ate this food that Kunda was giving him, he knew that this food would bring on his final illness, but he was happy to eat it anyway. Why? Because Kunda had offered it in all sincerity. And when he was eating the food, Buddha was thinking of Kunda, not of himself and his own needs. And he was happy to eat. And he wanted to make sure that Kunda knew not to feel remorse, but to feel joy in this final offering. So, when it comes time for us to die, let's remember this teaching. And, as I just said a moment ago, the time to die is always. But especially when we get near the end, let's remember this. to appreciate everything that we are given, even if it isn't the right thing, even if it isn't good. Let's appreciate everything that we're given. And if you have experienced end-of-life stuff with friends, family members, you know that it is pretty much 100% guaranteed that bad stuff is going to happen, like mistakes, setbacks, reversals, just queer, funny things are going to happen at that time of life. It's pretty much inevitable. Chaos and confusion are always present. And the doctors that we rely on, who are so smart and so skillful, they don't really know what to do. You know, they make a good guess, their best guess, but they don't really know. And do you think they make mistakes sometimes? Think? Of course they do. However, they, like Kunda, are there for one reason only: to help. They really, really, really want to help, and they really, really want to use the best of their skills to help. So we should appreciate everything they do, even when they do the wrong thing. We should be like the Buddha. Oh, thank you very much for administering. Whoops, wrong medicine. Oh, that's okay. Thank you very much. Very, very nice of you. Great try, you know. Thank you. We should appreciate everything that we're given, and clearly, as it says, clearly aware and focused on the time of awakening. What does that mean? Focused on the time of awakening. Well, today, I would say that I think it means that we should go on practicing long enough until we never forget the time of awakening. One of the most important distinctions made in early Buddhism is the fourfold categorization of stream enterer, once returner, never returner, and arhat. These are four kinds of experienced, committed practitioners. The stream enterer is a person who has practiced enough never to turn back. Might take a long time, but she's in the stream. And that stream will inevitably flow her to perfect awakening. She will not be going in any other direction. She's only going in that direction. The once returner is a stream enterer who only has one more lifetime of practice. The never returner is someone who in this very life will fully awaken. And the arhat is a person who has already awakened in this lifetime, like the Buddha. To always remember the time of awakening means that we always remember our practice. We keep our practice always in mind. Not deliberately. In other words, here's me, these are the things I do, one of the things I do is practice, I'm thinking about it. Not like that. Like as some external thing. But naturally, as our own life, as the way we see, the way we hear, the way we think, the way we feel our lives. We know that as long as we're human, as long as we're in these bodies, as long as we're in this world with other human beings, we will remain imperfect, flawed individuals. That is our nature. Just like we were in the beginning, when the world or our parents shocked us into some kind of twisted shape, we will remain in that shape. When we're caught by the Dharma, when we make the Dharma something external to us, some kind of ideology, it'll be disappointing to us to realize that we're not improving and we're not getting to be perfect. It may be even more disappointing to look around at our teachers. They're not perfect either. Then we might get disappointed, cynical. We might give up practice. Or maybe we don't give it up. We keep practicing because we're used to it by now. Our friends are there, you know. People expect us. Keep going. And maybe we no longer really believe in awakening. Because we've set up awakening as an idealistic undertaking. And so we lose it. And we just keep going through the motions. Going through the motions is pretty good. I think you should go through the motions. It's better than not going through the motions at all. But still better than that would be bearing in mind the time of awakening. Really having faith, despite all this, in awakening. Always seeing that in this moment, silly and imperfect as we are, Ananda-like, you know, as we are, at the same time, we are also Buddha. And we can understand like a Buddha. We can behave like a Buddha. This is possible, despite everything. That's what I was saying yesterday. Unenlightenment and enlightenment always must go together. We're not trying to get enlightenment and get rid of the unenlightenment. This will not really serve. There is no Buddha without Ananda. There is no Buddha without Mara. So when we come to acknowledge over and over and over again that we're not Buddhas, let's remember that exactly because we're not Buddhas, we're Buddhas. And we can, in this moment, understand and behave like a Buddha. We actually are capable of that. The next day, the Buddha and Ananda cross the Hiranavadi River, and they go to the Mala's sal grove, and now they've reached the area called Kusinara, the place where the Buddha will finally enter Parinirvana. So we will leave the Buddha there, nicely resting, until this afternoon. So we have a few minutes only till lunch. Sorry I went on so long, but I did want... I'm trying to get through the sutra here and do my job, right? Do my duty. So I've got it figured out. Got to go this far this morning and then this afternoon. So anyway, that's as far as I got. And as much time as we have, but whatever you have to bring up in these last few minutes, please. Yes? When you find the Buddha, kill him. It's kind of like what I was just saying. When you make the Buddha and the teaching and the practice into an ideology, into some external thing that you are now advancing as your identity and your possession and your idea to live by, you should let go of that. So when you meet the Buddha, kill the Buddha is a rather violent and dramatic way of making that point. It certainly gets your attention, doesn't it? Yeah, but that's how I understand that. Yeah, does that make sense to you? Yeah, it's so easy to do that. You notice that all the time in yourself. You know, when you start beating yourself over the head because you're not a good enough Buddhist, you know something is wrong, right? And it's because you forgot to kill the Buddha. Yeah.
So you said something earlier about defensiveness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the most important thing would be to study your defensiveness. He's talking about, he said I said something about not being defensive or something like that. And he was saying, well, what about defensiveness? How do you practice with it? Or why wouldn't you want to be defensive? So without saying that defensiveness is bad, non-defensiveness is good, we should not be defensive, better would be to just honestly study one's own defensiveness. And when I study my own defensiveness, I find out pretty much 100% of the time that my defensiveness is a source of unhappiness, a source of distancing myself from others. The person that I'm defending myself against in that moment is not my friend, you know, is not someone I feel close to, aligned with. So, and then what am I defending? What am I defending? And when I study that and really look at that, I find that it's usually my egotistical ideas that I'm defending. Maybe I identify with this or that, and somebody's attacking this or that, therefore they're attacking me, and now I'm defending against that. So, I usually, when I study my own defensiveness, it's usually pretty easy for me to let go of it. So in my experience, defensiveness never helps me. Now, then if we create some kind of a hypothetical situation in which, let's say, someone's like actually going to hit me over the head with something, or even more poignantly, going to be attacking my granddaughter who's, you know, right next to me, I will certainly try to prevent that from happening. I won't say, please hit me over the head. I will try to prevent that from happening. But I don't think I would be doing that with a feeling of defensiveness, or what we usually mean by defensiveness. I would be doing that as a positive action to prevent harm, right? Harm, it's bad for me if somebody hits me over the head. And it's bad for them, because then they become a person with hitting over the head karma, and that's not going to go well in the long run. So I'm doing a favor for myself for sure, and I'm doing a favor for them. Similarly with my granddaughter, I'm helping her, I'm also helping the assailant. So I think you do, to me, you have more energy when you are working to prevent harm. Now, that's not to say that I'm sure I would have a feeling of protectiveness, self-protectiveness, and protectiveness of my granddaughter. But that would be different, I think, from what we ordinarily mean by defensiveness. Is that speaking to what you're saying? It sounds like you're still dubious about all this.
So
I mean, those things flare up pretty immediately. You can't control that response in you, right? You can't help it, but you can, like I say, study it, and little by little, by studying it, I think you'll have it less. But yeah, we would like to be able to, when someone attacks us like that, now they're not hitting us with a stick, they're hitting us with words, they're you know, saying we did the wrong thing or I'm mad at you. That happens to me too, and I always try to say, oh wow, you know, I'm sorry, like I'm really sorry. Even if I didn't do anything, you're upset and you think that I did something that upsets you, I'm sorry about that, and then let's talk about it. So we hope to be able to be like that eventually, but in the meantime, we study our defensiveness and we see where it comes from, and we can reflect on it later, even if we can't prevent it from coming in the moment. And when we start acting out of defensiveness, I mean, there's a thing, I remember, like, there was this TV show a long time ago, Ally McBeal. You ever see that TV show? It's about lawyers. And there was one kind of funny guy who was a lawyer. And he always impressed me in the show because he would say, in the middle of a trial, you know, he's like giving a speech, you know, to the jury, and he would say, he would raise his finger like this, and he would say, "Let me take a moment." And then he would stop talking. And he would, like, stand there for a minute. And then he would resume. I think this is a very good thing, to be able to say when you're being very defensive and you see that you're, just give me a moment. I think you could actually do this. You could actually say, give me a moment. Stop the momentum. Give me a moment here. And in that moment, just take a breath. Literally. I think if you took a moment and took a breath, you'd interrupt this karmic chain of events and probably respond somewhat differently after that. Maybe you'd still be defensive, but it would take the edge off the speed of it, you know? So that's what I try to do. With me, it's quite automatic. When I'm upset, I right away go to the breath. I automatically am going to my breath before I even know it, and it really helps me. Really helps. Yeah. I think that's probably the end for this morning. So have a great lunch, and we'll see you back here at 1:30, and please come in and just begin sitting.